Underworld, Disc 14.
Matt didn't like to drive. He'd been driving only 6 months, and knew he'd never feel natural at the wheel. The best he could do was mimic a driver. He borrowed a four-wheel drive vehicle from one of the bomb heads and drove it with the instruction booklet in his lap. The roads, the road signs, the other cars made him self-conscious, exposing his crime of driving. But he wanted to practice for his camping trip with Janet. And he went for drives on his days off. And there were signs for runaway truck ramps and dangerous crosswinds. And there was the Jesus is Lord sign, and the lines of whitish haze in the deep distance that he now knew to be sea-bottom sand. And the do not enter sign when road is flooded. And the slat-back shadows on the flats formed by the crossbars of power lines that stretched hell-bent to Texas. Returning one day from a drive, he saw the protesters, as always, positioned in the wrong place. They should have been standing by the third gate to the airbase, the unmarked gate, because that's where scientists from the pocket entered and left, and they were the most susceptible presence. And he half wanted to tell the protesters to move their operation up the road. Matt looked slightly Jewish, a little Hispanic, maybe. He'd lifted weights in his late teens, remaking the soft, flimsy body that used to function as an adjunct to the UNIVAC head. Back in the Bronx, people said he looked a little everything. Mexican, Italian, Japanese, even. His friendliest smile could look like a ceremonial grimace. A police sketch made from seven different descriptions. That was Matt. He never stopped resembling the student he was at City College in the late 50s, hard-working, nearsighted, smart, and poor, riding the subway to class. He sat with Eric Deming in the mess. Eric took a strand of spaghetti in his fingers and slow lowered it down his throat with a certain amount of snakely constriction. Matt said, "All right, these are things we have to expect. We're not naive. Mistakes are part of the process. There's a sudden wind shift and the fallout blows the wrong way. Or the blast and shock are larger than anyone anticipated. The placid 1950s. Everybody dressed and spoke the same way. It was all kitchens and cars and TV sets. Where's the Pepsodent, Mom? We were there, so we know, don't we?" "You know. I don't know," Matt said. "You were there. We were both there." "You were there. I was somewhere else. Dad's in the breezeway washing the car. Meanwhile, way out here, they were putting troops in trenches for nuclear war games. Fireballs roaring right above them." "Positioned too close, you mean?" "That's the story I hear. You look at your arm and see right through it. Basically, your arm becomes an X-ray of your arm. You can see right through the uniform cloth and the skin. The light's so white. You can see blood, bones, and whatnot. But that's not all. You can see all this with your eyes shut. You don't have to open your eyes. You see right through the lids. Ha!" "Huh?" "Well, was it officially acknowledged?" "You wake up one day, a few years later, all your inner organs are fused. It's one big, jellied lump." "But did the men get compensated?" "I don't know," Eric said. "That's not part of your rumor-mongering." Eric stuck a finger in Matty's creamed spinach and hooked a shreddy morsel toward his mouth. "What good's a rumor that deals with bureaucratic details? The point is this," he said. "It happened right out in the open, but it's still a huge secret to this day. That's the story, anyway, which I don't happen to believe. They did major shots off towers or dropped devices from planes, and they put troops too close to the blast, and they let the fallout drift to Utah, where kids are getting born with their bladders backwards." Matt wanted to like Eric. The guy was smart, friendly, sort of semi-charismatic in a physically awkward and too tall way. But his motives were sometimes lost to observers in the inward drifts of his smile. You saw the shadow action around the mouth, and wondered if you were being set up for something. You know about the school not far from here? This is not a rumor now, but fact. I've been there and seen it. The Abbo Elementary School and Fallout Shelter. A real place down on the ground. Just like us. We're not real, Eric said. They're only kids. It's a grade school. They still have a chance to be real. I was sent there to speak to them. As a bomb head? As a clean-cut younger member of the military-industrial complex. A diversion at recess type of thing. What did you say to them? There's a water tank at the edge of town. State champs in bright new paint. And rows of neat homes. Then you come upon the school, but just barely. Some trailer-like structures and a couple of basketball courts. And finally you spot an entrance, and you open the steel door and go down the stairs, and there's a lot of concrete and steel, and the lighting's slightly eerie. The classrooms, the bedding, the canned food, the morgue. No window breakage. That's one of the features. Because there aren't any windows, of course. But the point is... What's the point, Maddie? I don't know. Tell me. Did they do all this to protect the kids from Soviet bombs? Or from our bombs and our fallout? I don't know. Both. What did you say to the kids? I spoke in tongues, Eric said. I mean, think about it. I'm standing in an underground room at the northern edge of a great desert with filtering systems for fallout and a fully equipped morgue, and there are crayon drawings pinned above the blackboard of piglets and cows. Incidentally, what? I have a chess set in my room. What about a game? The pocket was one of those nice, tight societies that replaces the world. It was the world made personal and consistently interesting because it was what you did, and others like you. And it was self-enclosed and self-referring, and you did it all together in a place and a language that were inaccessible to others. Janet Urbaniak was Matt's girlfriend, a registered nurse. They were off and on serious, mostly on, often impatient with each other, but always strongly joined, the kind of star-matched couple born to meet and disagree. He called Janet on her days off, and she told him where she'd gone and what she'd seen or bought and who with and for how long, and he listened and commented and asked for details. She worked in a trauma unit now. She told him about her nights there, but he said almost nothing about his own work, and of course she understood and didn't probe. Janet called his mother twice a week to find out how she was doing, and then she called Matt to give him a report, and then Matt called his mother to confirm everything, to clarify the particulars of an ache or pain. And he liked all these calls, the ones he made and the ones he heard about. They gave him a life outside the pocket. He drove his borrowed Jeep past a protester alone, a woman struggling to keep the sign upright in a dry, stiff wind that beat across the flats. He wanted to stop and talk to her, give her a hand, have a chat. He wanted to show his tolerance of her viewpoint, allow himself to be convinced by some of her arguments, make certain trenchant points of his own, and then drive her to the nondescript room where she lived at the edge of this or that town, with a partial view of the mountains, and have soft, moaning, and mutually tolerant sex in her rumpled bed. But he slowed only slightly as he drove past. Later, someone told him the protesters lived in a ruined school bus in the Sacramento Mountains. Matt kind of liked that. He liked the idea of people leaving everything behind to pursue an idea. He thought of Sister Edgar in sixth grade, talking about desert saints, pillar saints, stylites. And she hoisted herself up on her desk and crossed her legs under the habit, a saint lotused on a column in the Sinai, and spoke to the class in snatches of Latin and Hebrew, and he remembered liking that. He liked to think of a God-struck band of wanderers haunting the test ranges and silos of the West. It was part of the reason he'd come here in the first place, for the questions and challenges, for the self-knowledge he might find in a sterner life, in the fixing of willful limits. Did you do grad work on solar energy? Did you do a paper on the trigger principle of nuclear fission? Do you go to the dentist every 6 months for a prophy and a polish? Are you a physicist with a grudge against your mother? Are you a systems engineer who masturbates in secret while your wife is watching reruns of The Honeymooners? Do you wish to hell you could see a tower shot with all the special effects, with the sun coming up ass backwards and the trees casting shadows in the wrong direction? The spectacle of the unmattered atom, the condensation cloud arranged split-secondly on the shock disk, sort of primly place-centered, and the visible shock approaching, and the biblical wind that carries sagebrush, sand, hats, cats, car parts, condoms, and poisonous snakes all blowing by in the desert dawn. Eric kept after him to play chess, but he didn't want to play chess. He didn't talk about his chess. His chess was old, dark, difficult history, suppressed forever. The history of a chess homunculus. No one knew about his chess. Janet knew a little, and only Janet, and no one else but his mother and brother and Mr. Bronzini, of those who might tend to remember. "You don't get the point," Eric said in the jeep. "You're spreading rumors you don't even believe. That's the point," Matt said. "They had to throw up roadblocks because the cloud was moving into populated areas. Neuroblastomas, beta burns, two-headed lambs, or entire herds of sheep dead in the fields. Or you wake up one morning and your teeth start flipping out of their sockets, painlessly and bloodlessly. Two or three teeth, say, sort of gently expelled with the faintest kind of squishy sound," Eric said. "And you wrap them in cold, wet gauze and jump in your car and drive to the dentist's office, confident that he'll be able to reinsert the teeth, because don't doctors do amazing things with severed limbs? Or he will not reinsert the teeth. He will send the teeth to a lab at the new medical center, where they have equipment so advanced it can learn more about you in a passing glance than you could figure out yourself if you lived to be 1,000. But at the first red light, you take the gauze out of your pocket and unfold it for a brief peek," Eric said. "And there's nothing there but a small mound of powder, because your teeth have completely crumbled. These hard, strong, reliable structures designed for biting and gnawing, for tearing flesh, these things that last a million years in the jaws of prehistoric people, in the skulls that we dig up and study, turn to dust in your pocket in 6 frigging minutes. He called Janet and talked. He talked and listened. The smaller the talk, the better he felt. He took satisfaction in the details of her day, the matters of barely passing interest that struck him in his lonely love as items of privileged witness. Sometimes she talked about her work, trauma duty, deep in the night, and she was matter-of-fact about it, bodies flopping on the just-mopped floor of the corridor, relatives dragging in a knife victim or OD, the uncle and mother gripping the man's head and legs, and a cluster of small kids at the edges, two to each arm. She described scenes that were like paintings of the European masters, the ones who did miracles and wars. Her strength in these matters made her beautiful to him. She was a smallish woman. They were both fairly short, and Janet was slight as well. And he liked to imagine her in a scrub suit, plunging a fist into someone's chest cavity and coming out with a bullet or a chicken bone. Her shyness didn't conceal her eloquence of metal and will. He saw and heard it often. She clung to him persistently to make a point. He thought they were too damn earnest. They wanted a family and each other, but were periodically beset by the complexity of the undertaking. The plans, the chances, the cities, the idea of marriage and children and jobs, and how hard it is to do everything right. And they agreed and bargained and argued. They planned and fought. He looked at Landsat photos shot from space a year or two earlier. The pictures were false-color composites that revealed signs of soil erosion, geological fracture, and 100 other events and features. They showed stress and drift and industrial ravage, billion-bit data converted into images. He saw how remote sensors pulled hidden meanings out of the earth, how sweeps and patches of lustrous color, how computer fuchsias or Rorschach pulses of unnamed shades might indicate a change in water temperature, or where the dwindling grizzlies go to forage and mate. He looked at spindly barrier beaches that showed white as shanked bone. He found sizable cities pixeled into mountain folds, and saw black lakes high in the ranges, kettle holes formed by glacial drift. He couldn't stop looking. The photo mosaics seemed to reveal a secondary beauty in the world, ordinarily unseen, some hallucinatory fuse of exactitude and rapture. Every thermal burst of color was a complex emotion he couldn't locate or name. And he thought of the lives inside the houses embedded in the data on the street that is photographed from space. And that is the next thing the sensors will detect, he thought, the unspoken emotions of the people in the rooms. And then he thought, inevitably, of Nick. He wanted to call his brother many times. He thought he'd like to talk to him about the work he was doing here. He'd be able to give Nick a general sense of things, let him know that the kid was doing important work, but that it troubled him now and then. One day he might find himself putting together a physics package, the explosive components of a nuclear device, true blue bombhead country. Matt wasn't sure he could deal with this himself. He could if he had to, and Janet would help. She'd have a clear position he could set against his doubts. But he wanted to talk to Nick. He wanted to hear his brother's voice coming down the phone line, the slightly bent stresses that carried a literal lifetime of associations. Nick had a graveness that was European in a way. He was shaped and made, first unmade and then reimagined and strongly shaped and made again. And he was somber and self-restrained at times, and not free-giving. But maybe he would give the kid advice about the moral and ethical aspects of this kind of work. Mainly what Matt wanted was a show of interest. This was more important than outright counsel, a recommendation or judgment. But he wanted that, too, a judgment in his brother's voice. He didn't know what his brother might say. He might say, this is the way you define yourself as a serious man, working through the hard questions and harrowing choices, and if you stick with it, you'll be stronger in the end. Or he might say, fool, what kind of mark will this make on your soul when you become a father like me? Think of the guilt of raising children in a world you've made, your talent put to such desolate use. Speaking softly now, and who knows the ticklish business of weapons better than I do, brother? But he'd never make that last remark, would he? And Matt didn't make the call. They didn't often talk. Or they talked about their mother. Or they hassled each other routinely. But maybe he'd call later, when he felt the urge again. When the wind gusted out of the mountains, it rebodied the dunes. And if you were up, out of the pocket, and sitting around at home with a beer and a snack, you saw your laundry go horizontal on the backyard line. All of it. Sheets, hankies, boxer shorts, pajama bottoms. Like people of all sizes and shapes snapping from the pressure, letting their souls fly forth to the gypsum hills.
But that's not the point, Eric said. You keep missing the point.
It was raining in the mountains. Eric had a fake stutter he liked to use to texture the conversation, a thing he'd developed to mock himself, or his listener, although neither of them stuttered. Or maybe he was imitating some nightclub comic or a simpy character on TV. It wasn't clear to Matt. He looked out a window of Eric's bungalow.
The rain was a wall of a smoky shimmer that hung across the limestone bluffs. Eric sat on a sofa that was still wrapped in warehouse plastic amid a mess of scientific journals, UFO monthlies, supermarket tabloids, half a dozen Playboys, and some lost food. Even though huge amounts of territory were affected and large numbers of people were exposed, it remains a major secret to this day. So secret it may not be true, Matt said. Do you believe it's true? I believe mistakes were made. Eric enjoyed this. His shadow smile appeared at the far end of the sprawled body. It came and went like some inner dialogue he was conducting that ran parallel to the spoken lines, a thing of elusive drift. But the point is, pure and simple. What's the point, Eric? He picked up a magazine and leafed through it aimlessly, speaking in a tone that was slightly impatient, but mostly, now that he was finally coming to the point, a little weary and bored. It was done deliberately, he said. They knew the tests weren't safe, but they went ahead anyway. They marched troops to Zero Point after the detonations. They sent manned aircraft through radiation clouds. They injected people with plutonium to track its course through the body. They did this deliberately without telling people what the risks were. They exposed troops to the atomic flash, and some of them were given protective eye filters, and some were not. They experimented on children, infants, fetuses, and mental patients. They never told the Navajos who worked in uranium mines what the dangers were. The dangers were considerable, as it turned out. They zapped the testicles of prison inmates. They basically grabbed you by the balls and zapped you full of X-rays. This is the story I hear. Do you believe it? It's awfully... I don't know. Of course, it's very hard to believe. That's why I don't believe it, Eric said. Not for a tenth of a second. The rain line came dragging across the flats, and the wind kicked up. The poets of the desert nations told stories about the wind. It bucks and swirls and turns you around and knocks you flat. But it also speaks so softly only your inner spirit can hear it, and this is how you correct your path. Eric said, They never told the test subjects they were subjects. I don't believe it, Eric said, but you may feel differently. Matt didn't know how he felt. But he didn't think the story was completely far-fetched. He'd served in Vietnam, after all, where everything he'd ever disbelieved or failed to imagine turned out, in the end, to be true. Then one day he stopped to talk to her, the woman alone with the protest sign. He parked the car on the opposite side of the road and walked on over. She held one post cradled in her arms, one 8-foot-long upright piece, and the other was planted in the dirt with rocks piled around the base, and the sign itself, a spray-painted sheet, extended wind-whipped between the posts. He stood there and started talking. He talked to her in a reassuring, trite, and slightly compulsive way, like a first-timer nervous in a singles bar. He realized her wrist was padlocked to the post. He'd never noticed this before, and it seemed, well, a little self-dramatizing, maybe. Or fanatical, and irrational, and victim-wishful. She looked at him briefly as he spoke. He'd finished the get-acquainted part, and was talking about the need for readiness, and the folly of being naive about the other side's intentions. He didn't use words such as American and Soviet. They seemed provocative somehow, or NATO and Europe and the East Bloc and the Berlin Wall, too soon to be so intimate. She looked at him only briefly. It wasn't a hostile look, but it was brief. There was something scoured about her, a sense of rubbed surfaces, a willing away of normal accretions and gleanings. And he thought she carried the countermarks of the rural poor. He talked to her about the need to match our weapons to theirs, even when the numbers become absurd, because this is the only seeming safeguard against attack by either side. She was fair-skinned, etched and fixed, with lank hair, string hair, and he thought she was true and impressive and unreachable. They stood on the stretch of flat, straight highway, beautiful and lonely. And if you're going to do this kind of work, isn't it necessary, he thought, to be fanatical? World War III starts here. Isn't this exactly what he wanted from these people? A kind of sunstruck religious witness? He told her he was completely willing to listen. But she wouldn't talk to him. She stood padlocked to the post and looked off down the road somewhere. He couldn't despise her arrogance because she wasn't arrogant. She wasn't smarter or more sane or less guilty. "They are armed," he said, "and so we have to be armed." She clutched the upright and looked down the road, blue-eyed, with an inbuilt wince. And he went back to the car and drove away. Eric's laundry jumped on the line. It shot straight out and held stiff in the wind. "I think of my days in the glove box," he said, "handling that hot Pluto. Mistakes were made even in the small, narrow, sealed limits of the box. Better believe it. With all the safety procedures and data sheets and supervisors, people still made amazing mistakes. And I'd stick my hands in the gloves and think, oddly, of my mom, who was a super sensible lady and used to wear rubber gloves to do the dinner dishes back in the placid days when we were bombing our own people. "I'm leaving tomorrow," Matt said. "Let me have that jacket when you go." Matt wore a lightweight calfskin jacket, the kind of soft leather that scuffs and unscuffs at a touch. And Eric often remarked his wish to own it, whatever the difference in their sizes. "I think I'll probably take it with me for the not-so-rugged parts of the trip." "The taste is metallic, according to downwinders. You open the door and step outside to get the newspaper that the newsboy on his bike has tossed on the porch, and you taste a kind of metallic grit in the air, like salt made of metal shavings. Coming to our party tonight?"
"Wouldn't miss it," Matt said.
"Your child is born with eyes that are pure white. No discernible pupil or iris, just a large white eyeball. Two, if you're lucky." Eric lifted the Playboy off the sofa and held it sideways, letting the centerfold swing open so he could see the monthly subject full length. He said, "Where are you going exactly?"
"Someplace remote."
"Remoter than this?"
"I've been looking at maps."
"Bah, remoter than this?"
"Where the paved roads end."
"You're a city kid, Matty."
"I've been looking at southwest Arizona, maybe."
"I want that jacket if you die."
When the bombheads threw a party, you couldn't expect to emerge into the world you'd always known. And last night's affair seemed to overlay the landscape as Matty drove west on Interstate 10 through a town called Deming, which was Eric's last name, of course, and how clammy was the hand of coincidence. Faces, places, and provocative remarks all running through his mind. He'd smoked something that had made him immobile. But not just immobile. Matt was not a user except at parties, where he'd go through the sociable motions, taking a pull and a long-stemmed pipe with a clay bowl that was tamped with grassy substance. But the thing he'd toked last night was either a rogue strain of hashish or standard stuff laced with some psychotomimetic agent. And he was not just immobilized. And somebody sat in front of him and spoke thickly into his face in a ridiculous movie accent evidently meant to be Prussian.
"You can never underestimate the willingness of the state to act out its own massive fantasies."
It was Eric, of course. But even if Matt understood this, he couldn't place it in the jocular context of broad bombhead sport. Because he was not just immobile, He couldn't think straight, either. He was surrounded by enemies. Not enemies, but connections. A network of things and people. Not people exactly, but figures. Things and figures and levels of knowledge that he was completely helpless to enter.
The willingness of the state. You can never underestimate the willingness of the state.
Eric went on in his stupid voice, talking about problem boxes and Minimax solutions, and all the Kriegspielish stuff they'd studied in grad school. Theory of games and patterns of conflict, heads I win, tails you lose, and Maddie sat there, stoned, totally motionless. He was locked to his chair, mind-locked and gravity-trapped, aware of the nature of the state he was in, but unable to think himself out. He was bent to the weight of the room, distrustful of everyone and everything here. Paranoid. Now he knew what it meant, this word that was bandied and bruited so easily. And he sensed the connections being made around him, all the objects and shaped silhouettes and levels of knowledge. Not knowledge exactly, but insidious intent. But not that either, some deeper meaning that existed solely to keep him from knowing what it was.
To act out its own massive fantasies.
Eric was still talking, stirring a drink with his finger. And it occurred to Matt in the morning, driving his car through Deming, that maybe the accent was not supposed to be Prussian at all, but Hungarian. Eric was paying tribute to the original bombheads, all those émigrés from Middle Europe, thick-browed men with sad eyes and roomy, pleated pants. They came to do science in New Mexico during the war, an overnight sprawl of trailers and hutments, and they ate the local grub and played poker once a week and went to the Saturday square dance and worked on the thing with no name, the bomb that would redefine the limits of human perception and dread. And he sat in the chair studying someone's shoe. He knew he wasn't part of some superficial state that people like to borrow from when they say they're feeling paranoid. This was not second-hand. This was real and deep and true. It was all the one-syllable words that mean we aren't kidding. It was also familiar in some strange Paleolithic root-eating way, a thing retained in the snake brain of early experience. He studied the shoe on the foot of someone seated near him. It was an earth shoe. One of those functional, sensible, unsexy, shallow-heeled, and vaguely Scandinavian items of fad footwear. The shy, androgynous, and countercultural shoe, unthreatening to the environment or the species. And he wondered why it looked so sinister. Eric was stuttering now. He didn't know who was wearing the shoe. The idea of connecting the shoe to the person who was wearing it required such an immensity of effort. There was such encumbrance and complication that he could only bend his head to the weight of the room. Maybe the shoe looked sinister because all its meanings and connections and silhouettes were outside Maddie's faculties of knowing. And maybe it looked sinister because it was the left shoe, on the left foot. And this is what sinister means, of course. Unlucky, unfavorable, leftward. And the word was asserting its baleful roots, its edible tubers and stems, through the medium of someone's shoe. Eric was still there, talking in a normal voice, interrupted by stutters. He seemed to be in another time frame, Eric did, cut and edited, his words in stop-start format, and his position frequently altered in relation to the background. And here he was again on the sign for Deming, his name floating out of the soft dawn as Matt drove west, deeper into the white parts of the map, where he would try to find a clue to his future. Chapter 3. The statue in the marbled niche had the thighs and calves of a man's bundled muscles in the forearms. But the figure, in fact, was biblical Eve, tight-breasted, with an apple in her hands, and the sloping shoulders of a fullback. And why not? The evening had the slightly scattered air of some cross-referenced event. Clara wandered through the grand foyer, among the early arrivals. And what a happy buzz they generated. Mostly men, in fact, and this was interesting. Look at the lean, sleek geometry and gunmetal surfaces, the draped mirrors and long chandeliers. It was an Art Deco palace, burnished steel and chrome, a sense of machine-age completion, and fairly refined in tone, except for the mural. The lobby crowd loved the mural. An enormous mystical vision, 60 feet by 40, with a sort of lost horizon motif, situated above the staircase and contoured in a gentle curve so that the craggy peaks of the painting were captured in the towering mirrors, extending the enchanted effect over much of the lobby. Amber mists, a cloaked old man with a staff, a cluster of flamingos standing in the alpenglow. A vision so steeped in kitsch you could die just by buying the postcard. Yes, this was Radio City Music Hall, a place Clara had visited when she was 13, probably, about a year after the doors opened, showplace of the nation. She remembered the soaring walls and carpeted stairs. She remembered the powder room. That's what she remembered, downstairs, in the grand lounge. She watched Miles Lightman weave through the crowd, doing a couple of pirouettes as he approached, taking in the full 360, eyes slightly popping. Where are we? In a model room at Bloomingdale's? We're in 1932. That's where we are. It's sort of, I don't know what, isn't it? Jazz moderne, Clara said. Can you believe I've never been here? She was surprised to see that Miles had dressed for the occasion. Many people had, and so had Miles, to the extent that he dresses. He wore his scuffed boots and jeans, but also had a leopard shirt and mustard tie and a black corduroy jacket with an Edwardian flair. They watched a man come down the grand staircase, feigning injury as he went past the mural. Miles had a package of cigarettes for Clara. While they waited, he gave her further background on the event. The event was a showing of the legendary lost film of Sergei Eisenstein, called Unterwelt, recently found in East Germany, meticulously restored, and brought to New York under the aegis of the film society Miles belonged to. A remarkable coup for the group. After a period of maneuvering, infighting, and hard bargaining, they managed to reach an agreement with several rock impresarios and arranged to co-sponsor this one-time screening with orchestral accompaniment in a house seating nearly 6,000 people. How do you explain the turnout? Clara said. A lot of gay men in this lobby. I think you ought to see the film and figure it out for yourself. I'll only tell you that word got around early on that Eisenstein made a film with a powerful theme, and the footage has been hidden away all these decades because the theme deals on some level with people living in the shadows. And the government, or the governments, the GDR and the Soviets, have suppressed the film until now. Probably shot in the mid-30s, sporadically and in secret, during a period of acute depression for Eisenstein. Ostensibly idle at the time, goaded by fellow Soviet directors to discard his theories and conceits. Called eccentric, called myth-ridden and politically unsound, accused of being out of touch with the people. Stories began to circulate that he'd been executed. Esther Winship showed up waving her handbag and saying, I don't need to see the movie. I already love it. This hall is so wonderful I'd forgotten it was here. Miles, you look like a mod and rocker reunion. Where's Jack? Clara said. Where could he be? Is it your shirt and tie that gives me vertigo? Thank you, Esther. He's having a drink around the corner, she said. There was an ambivalence that vitalized the crowd. Whatever your sexual persuasion, you were here to enjoy the contradictions. Think of the relationship between the film and the theater in which it was showing. The work of a renowned master of world cinema screened in the camp environment of the Rockettes and the Mighty Wurlitzer. But a theater of a certain impressive shapeliness, a breathtaking place even, for all its exaggerations and vanities, with roundels of enameled brass on the outer walls, and handsome display cases in the ticket lobby, and nickel bronze stair rails here in the foyer, a space that resembled the hushed and sunken saloon of an ocean liner. And possibly a film, you're not likely to forget this, that will be riddled with mannerisms, whatever the level of seriousness. At least you hope so. Didn't Ivan the Terrible contain scenes so comically overwrought, amid the undeniable power of the montage, that you laughed and caught your breath more or less simultaneously? Nobody practically has seen the film up to this point, Miles said. Four of us have seen it in our group, and half a dozen promoters and theater brass, and that's about it on this side of the Iron Curtain. Miles knew Eisenstein inside and out. He knew more than was humanly healthy. He knew the shot sequence in Potemkin just about cold, the deadly cadence of black boots, the white jackets of the soldiers, the mother clutching weakly at her waist, the rear wheels of the baby carriage rolling out of the frame. But there were things nobody seemed to know about this movie. Where it was made, how it was made. He didn't have official backing, obviously. And why he didn't use sound. One theory pointed to Mexico. The enormous amount of footage he shot openly for his Mexican epic was a cover for a subversive venture, went the theory, and this was it. Actually, I haven't seen a single thing he's ever done, Esther said. But I met him once, you know. Miles turned his head slowly to look at her. You knew Eisenstein? It was a look of total reevaluation. Met him briefly. Where? Here. I was very young, of course. New York. Barely 20, I think. And he was sitting for a portrait, and my parents knew the painter, and I went along. We have to talk about this, Miles said. That's all there is, I'm afraid. He asked me to call him Sergei. What else? He drank a lot of milk. He said it was breakfast. What else? Miles said. Actually, he showed up with the milk in a bottle. I got him a glass, and he thanked me. What else? Miles said. The other thing nobody knew was where the title came from. Eisenstein knew German and may have had a reason for choosing a title in that language, but it's more likely the film acquired the title during its long repose in an underground vault in East Berlin. Gnome-like sort of fellow, as I recall. What else? Large head, sort of very high forehead. Milk came in bottles then, remember? It became the movie people had to see. A nice, tight hysteria began to build, and there were tickets going for shocking sums, and counterfeit tickets, and people rushing back from the Vineyard and the Pines and the Cape to engineer a seat. Just a movie, for God's sake, and a silent movie at that, and a movie you probably never heard of until the Times did a Sunday piece. But this is how the behavioral aberration, once begun, grows to lavish panic. But will we actually be able to sit through it? Esther said. Or is it one of those things where we have to be reverent because we're in the presence of greatness, but we're really all sitting there determined to be the first ones out the door so we can get a taxi? You're thinking of theater, Miles said. This is film. Jack Marshall turned up with peanuts on his breath, Esther's husband, and they went into the auditorium. Clara remembered it now, suddenly so familiar. The feeling of plush and mothered comfort. It felt like her mother hovering, a space soothingly wombed and curved. And the way the proscenium arch rayed out into the ceiling, about 8 stories at its highest point, and the spoked rows of downy seats, and the coral staircases that softened the side walls, and the over-vastness that seemed allowable, your one indulgence of this type, shrinking everyone in the hall to child size, heads turning and lifting, a rediscovered surprise and delight floating over the crowd. not the last such emotion that people would share this evening. It developed that the show had a pace and theme, and it started with the sound of chase music offstage, a tinny piano doing the familiar sort of ragtime score that used to accompany silent movies. Then the house lights went down, and the great motorized curtain slowly lifted, and the full orchestra appeared, a rustle in the audience. Moments after the musicians began to play, the whole unit commenced moving, sliding nicely in its band car to the front of the stage. How wondrously funny and odd! The music became suspenseful now, a series of diminished chords, perhaps a scary moment pending. And sure enough, the orchestra reached the stage apron and dropped, rather dramatically, into the pit, and then completely out of sight. Elevator down like so many geeks in tuxedos. A maneuver of a certain farcical bravado, greeted with cheers. Gone, but not inaudible. They were playing patriotic music now. A medley of familiar marches with drum ruffles and sousaphones, and the curtain descended halfway, recontoured in flag format and starred and striped by coloured floods, and just as the audience began to wonder what the point was, out came the Rockettes. What a toothsome shock! Did anyone know there was a stage show in the works? They were wearing West Point grey and came out saluting, 36 women remade as interchangeable parts, height, shape, race, and type, with plumed dress hats and fringed titties and faces buttered a Christmassy pink. But isn't it odd they're wearing bondage collars? Saluting and high-kicking in machine unison. And Clara thought they were kind of great, and so did everyone else. Snapping into close formation, tap-dancing in a wash of iridescent arcs, all symmetry and drill precision. Then fanning open in kaleidoscopic bursts. And she passed the question along the aisle to Miles, who sat at the far end of the foursome. How do we know it's really the Rockettes, and not a troupe of female impersonators? And this droll notion seemed to travel through the audience, because isn't it unlikely that the real Rockettes would be wearing slave collars, and doing routines with such pulsing sexual rhythm? In fact, it's probably not unlikely at all. It's probably what they do all the time. You don't know for sure, do you? And if they are the real Rockettes, what you're seeing are 36 women in close-order cadet formation, or women done up like men, and not the reverse. But it's a cross-dressing event either way. Clara realized the flag curtain was gone. And when a camera in the flies took a live video shot of the dancers that was projected on a back screen, she understood, you all did, how a crowd is reconfigured, teased into methodical geometry, into slipknots and serpentines. And it was funny, of course, because the routines were so impeccably smooth and serious, so 1930s in their dynamic alignments. And isn't that when the movie was made? The dancers spread across the stage, and in a single dexterous swipe, like unholstering a gun, they pulled off their tearaway trousers and went into a final rousing kick, gams flashing, and drew several waves of applause. Then they dissolved their kick line and formed a star, clearly depicted in the high-angle shot on the screen above them, and the footlights painted them solid red. They marched in place as the orchestra lifted solemnly into the pit and began to play, what, something Russian, Clara thought. And how strange it was to see a thing like this, a red star of such political and military moment, plunked down here, the grim signet of the Soviet Union, in the music hall of all places. Think of all the Easter shows and Lassie movies. The dancers stood white-faced now, upstage, transfixed by beams of light from mammoth spots high in the rear of the auditorium. The curtain began to fall, covering first the video image of the dancers, and then the dancers. The music grew weepy and frilled, and then the curtain lifted to reveal the vast movie screen bearing a single word, Unterwelt. and finally the borders at each end of the curved screen folded in to accommodate the small, squarish frame of the old movie. And images poured from the projection booth, patchy and dappled with age. Of course, the film was strange at first, elusive in its references and filled with Baroque apparitions, and hard to adapt to. You wouldn't want it any other way. Overcomposed close-ups, momentous gesturing, actors trailing their immense bended shadows. And there was something to study in every frame. The camera placement, the shapes and planes, and then the juxtaposed shots. The sense of rhythmic contradiction. It was all spaces and volumes. It was tempo, mass, and stress. In Eisenstein, you note that the camera angle is a kind of dialectic. Arguments are raised and made. Theories drift across the screen and instantly shatter. There's a lot of opposition and conflict. It seems you are watching a movie about a mad scientist. He sweeps through the frame, dressed in well-defined black and white, in layered robes, wielding an atomic ray gun. Figures move through crude rooms in some underground space. They are victims or prisoners, perhaps experimental subjects. A glimpse of a prisoner's face shows he is badly deformed, and it is less shocking than funny. He has the sloped head, shallow jaw, and protuberant lips of an earthworm, but a worm with a human pathos about him. In a scene that was extravagant, silly, off-kilter, and technically impressive all at the same time, the scientist fires the ray gun at a victim who begins to glow in the dark, jerking and dancing, and then looking rather wanly at his arm, which starts to melt away. Other victims appear, muscles and bones reshaped, slits for eyes, shuffling on stump legs. Clara thought of the radiation monsters in Japanese science fiction movies and looked down the aisle at Miles, who was a scholar of the form. Was Eisenstein being prescient about nuclear menace or about Japanese cinema? She thought of the prehistoric reptiles that came mutating out of the slime and the insects with chromosome damage poking from the desert near some test site, ants the size of bookmobiles. These were movies for the drive-ins of the 50s, a boy and girl yanking at each other's buckles and snaps while the bomb footage unfurls and the giant leeches and scorpions appear on the horizon, all radioactive and seeking revenge. And the fleeing crowds, of course, because in the end these creatures not only come from the bomb, but displace it. And the armies mobilize, and the crowds flee, and the sirens wail like sirens. Eisenstein's creatures were fully human, and this complicated the fun. They humped and scuttled through the shadows, hump lurched with hands dragging, and you can always convince yourself it's okay to laugh at cripples and mutants if everybody else is laughing. It's a way to play off your aversion. And it wasn't just the twisted features and elaborate gestures and the curious sort of lip-gloss effect you've noticed on the faces of male actors in silent movies, but the music as well. This was pretty broad, too. String sections of soaring melodrama. A title now and then, in Russian, untranslated, not that it mattered. It made, in fact, for a giddy kind of total confusion. Jack said, "Getting claustrophobic, are you?" And it was true, the film was embedded so completely in the viewpoint of the prisoners that Clara was beginning to squirm. Jack said, "I bet you'd give $100 to stand in the rain right now and smoke a cigarette."
"Is it raining?"
"Does it matter?" The plot was hard to follow. There was no plot. Just loneliness, barrenness, men hunted and ray-gunned, all happening in some Netherland crevice. There was none of the cross-class solidarity of the Soviet tradition. No crowd scenes or sense of social motive. The masses as hero. Colossal crowd movements painstakingly organized and framed. And this was disappointing to Clara. She loved the martial architecture of huge moving bodies. The armies and mobs in other Eisenstein films. And she felt she was in some ambiguous filmscape, somewhere between the Soviet model and Hollywood's vaulted heaven of love, sex, crime, and individual heroism, of scenery and luxury and gorgeous toilets. All you have to do is think of the other underworld, a 1927 gangster film and box office smash. Esther said, "I want to be rewarded for this ordeal." Admit it, you're bored. Clara tried to take encouragement from Miles. He was in a state of rapt elation, that pure surrender he undertakes, able to lose himself in the eye and mind of the movie, totally drawn and charmed. Charmed at some level even when he doesn't like what he's watching. But she knew he liked this. It was remote and fragmentary, and made on the cheap, supposedly personal, and it had a kind of suspense, even as it crawled along. How and when would it reveal itself? She wondered why the film was silent. Maybe it was shot earlier than the experts surmised. But she thought it was more likely that Eisenstein knew he'd have an easier time doing the film in secret if he didn't use sound. And maybe the silences suited the development of his themes. What about the politics? She thought this film might be a protest against socialist realism, against the party-minded mandate to produce art that advanced the Soviet cause. Was he in secret rebellion? He'd been condemned for earlier work, according to Miles, and had seemed to capitulate. But what was this murky film, this strange, dark, draggy set of images, if not a statement of outrage and independence? Even better, doesn't this movie seem to anticipate the terror that was mounted against Russian artists in the late 1930s? The secret police, the arrests, the torture, the disappearances, the executions. The mad scientist aims the gun. A figure stands against a wall, his body going white. The scientist shows a tight smile. The victim is transfigured, pain-racked, his lower lip dribbling off his face, a growth appearing at the side of his neck, a radiant time-lapse melanoma. The scientist approaches and touches the man, tenderly, on the cheek. Abruptly, the screen went dark. Intermission seemed a timely idea, and Clara thought she'd take Esther on a tour of the powder rooms. There were quite a few, she thought, on several levels, and well worth beholding. Murals, sculpture, furniture, things she'd seen through her mother's eyes, suddenly free in space, independent of memory. Miles went up to a private viewing room in the third mezzanine to confer with his colleagues. The two women left Jack in a chair in the grand lounge, downstairs, a carpeted area about 200 feet in length, and they went into the nearest powder room. "I've got a question," Esther said. Clara lit a cigarette. Esther, who'd stopped smoking, bummed one and lit it, and inhaled, and then looked away to protect the sensation, to guard it from distraction. They heard a rumble. They felt something shaking under their feet, and Clara studied the white parchment wall, listening carefully. Then she took a drag and said, "It's okay, friend. Only the subway, the IND, plowing under Sixth Avenue with its cargo of human souls." They went up to the mezzanine levels and peered in at the walnut and pigskin in the men's smoking rooms, and Clara said, "So what's your question? Do we have to stay for the rest of it?" "Miles went to a certain amount of trouble. Besides, I want to see what happens."
"What could happen?"
"I don't know, but it's an interesting movie to look at from time to time."
"There's something about the tone," Esther said. "The photography, the glances that get exchanged. It's awfully shrouded, of course. And the way the scientist touched the victim. What do you know about Eisenstein?"
"He was your friend, not mine," Clara said.
They made their rounds of the powder rooms and went back down to find Jack on the lower level, sitting above the rattle of another subway run.
This ends Disc 14.